People believe more what they say than what they're told. If somebody verbalizes something, there's something like 7 to 10 times more likely the next time they're in that situation to take that alternate action versus us telling them what to do. But as leaders, we have to be really diligent with that because a lot of times we're moving fast and not every single situation you have the time to do that. But in the really important tasks and the really in the areas that the employee needs to grow and should be growing to be more and more successful and develop themselves for now and for the future, you've got to get them to verbalize those things.
Welcome to You Belong in the C-Suite podcast. You are ambitious in life and in your career, but something is missing. You want to bring more of your passion to what you do. Because let's be honest, you pour a ton into your work and it needs to mean more. I'm your host, Laura Eigel. I'm a mom, wife, PhD, coach, advocate, introvert, and indoor rowing fanatic. I'm passionate about living a life that's in line with my values. We'll give you the actionable tips and tools you need to lead with your values, make a difference, and have career success. The world needs more diversity and authenticity in the top jobs at organizations. Your leadership belongs there. You belong in the C-suite. What gets you up in the morning? What drives your decisions? What do you stand for? No idea, not even sure where to start? I use my values to guide my life and career. It's the basis of how I've built boundaries for myself and stuck to them. Are you ready to dig into what matters to you? Go to thecatchgroup.com to download your free values worksheet. That's thecatchgroup.com to download your free values worksheet to get to your core values and take action on what matters most. Welcome to this week's episode of the You Belong in the C-Suite podcast. I'm excited for you to hear my conversation with Pat D'Amico. Pat D'Amico, founder and CEO of About Face Development and senior performance consultant for Matrix Achievement Group, has over 30 years of leadership and training experience and 30 years experience in the medical device and pharmaceutical industries. Pat is a master facilitator delivering programs focused on leadership, management, development, and serves as an executive coach to C-suite leaders. With strategic roles spanning from Fortune 50 companies to startups, Pat's experience provides him with a unique perspective on what makes individuals and organizations commercially successful. Pat's leadership experience began at an early age, accelerating after his enlistment in the U.S. Army, and then while at Valley Forge Military Academy, where he rose to the rank of cadet commander of the college. After his commissioning as an officer in the U.S. Army, Pat served in overseas deployments, leading soldiers in Panama, Cuba, and the Middle East. He achieved the rank of captain and received numerous recognitions for his leadership in both combat and humanitarian operations. Working in Fortune 500 companies, including Johnson & Johnson and Medtronic, as well as startups, Pat's roles have included sales, sales management, commercial operations, recruiting, marketing, and training. One of the most novel aspects of his career is that more than half of his roles were newly created, allowing him to design and launch new departments, even within large established organizations. Throughout his career, Pat's passions for the study of leadership, driving organizational success, and teaching, along with his belief in being a lifelong learner, have continually led him back to roles in learning and development. Pat holds an MS in education and instructional design, a BA in world politics, and an executive coaching certification from the UC Berkeley Executive Education and Berkeley Executive Coaching Institute. He is a frequent speaker and author on topics related to learning and development and leadership, and is a member of the Entrepreneur Leadership Council. In our conversation, we talked about Pat's career journey. And in the roles that he's in now, we talked about the most important things that he's seeing impacting the success of leaders today. Specifically, we talked about the impact of leading with a coaching mindset, why it's so hard to do in the moment, and how leaders can adopt this type of leadership to motivate their teams. We also talked about how to create opportunities to receive feedback and the mistakes that we both have seen and how leaders try to get feedback, but may not be setting up others for success with how they're doing it. Pat talked about the most important things to do as a leader to set teams up for success. Be sure to check out our show notes to find out ways to connect with Pat on LinkedIn. I know you'll get some actionable tips from this episode. Let's get started. Well, I want to welcome you to the You Belong in the C-Suite podcast. Thank you so, so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks so much, Laura. Pleasure to be here.
Before we dig into all of our leadership topics, I would love to hear just more about you and your career. So wherever you want to get started, I think our listeners, but me specifically, want to just know more about you.
Well, thanks. Where do you start, right? I'm actually originally from Buffalo, New York. So I mean, I'm a Buffalo Bills fan. When you're born in Buffalo, even if you leave, you have to remain a Bills fan. But I always like to say I had a great time in high school, but I was not an exceptionally dedicated academic student. So when it was time for me to graduate and my parents were like, what are you going to do? I said, well, I'd like to go to college, which I think they thought was funny because they had no money to send me and my grades weren't going to help me get that paid for. So I actually decided to join the Army. So at 17, I joined the Army and that was a real transition for me. I had had some leadership experience in high school that I really enjoyed. And it was really my time in the Army that grew my passion for really leadership. So I was fortunate to get an Army scholarship and ended up attending Valley Forge Military Academy. So that's where I got my commission from. And it was again there that I really advanced sort of my passion and desire to develop and lead others. My last year there, I was the commander of the college. So had responsibility for about 140 or so cadets and a full staff and great mentors there at the military academy. So that really was life changing, honestly, for me. And so from there, when I finished, I went on active duty for a number of years. And although the Army paid for college, I'd like to say that they got a lot more out of me than I got out of them because it was an interesting time. Was the time during the invasion of Panama. So I spent some time in Panama. I was also deployed for Operation Desert Shield and Storm. So I spent some time in the Middle East. And also, in an odd, you know, twist of fate, ended up spending some time assigned to Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. So it was, you know, a lot of my leadership mistakes and learnings really happened at a rapid pace during that time that I spent in the Army. And then after that, I left the Army and I took my first corporate job, which was at Johnson & Johnson. So I spent 15 years at J&J, initially in sales. And then I was really fortunate at J&J because I did not have a traditional career. It's very common in organizations like J&J that you start in sales, you move to marketing, maybe you do some training and you go back and forth. My career was far more varied. So I went from sales to I started the sales recruiting department at J&J, which was really a great opportunity. So I spent about 5 or 6 years in recruiting. And then I went into the medical device sector and did some time as in sales operations. I was a sales manager for New York City for a while. Did a stint in marketing. I always tell folks, you know, if there's a function you're not sure that you're right for or is right for you, test it out. I did a year in marketing, learned that not something I'm good at, but I'll never have to wonder, right? So I did spend a year there. And then I eventually left J&J for an opportunity to go to a startup as a VP of commercial operations. And for those that have worked in startups know that the great thing about working in a startup is you wear a lot of hats, right? Small organization, you're responsible for a lot of things. So I had a boss at that time that said, look, you know, here are your responsibilities, but anything else you'd like to get involved in, just kind of raise your hand. And I took over advantage of that. And I was grateful for, I actually worked for him twice in my career. And what it gave me an opportunity to do is to look at areas that I wasn't really familiar with or functions I hadn't worked in, like finance or manufacturing, and say, look, I'd like to get some experience here. And I think what it did for me from a career perspective is it made me, I'm a master of a few things, but I can speak intelligently to most. So as my career advanced, when I'm in a room with, you know, senior executives and a topic comes up, most topics I've got some experience in. So I think that that's a really important point in my career. And then after the startup eventually got bought by Medtronic, which is a huge organization, and I went over to Medtronic. And at that point, I really began to focus my career in the area of learning and development and training. So I ended up going back to school. I got a master's in education and instructional design. And I spent about 8 years there. My last role was director of learning and development for the cardiovascular group. So I had about 4,000 or 5,000 folks I supported in North, South, and Central America. And then Medtronic's based in Minneapolis. They eventually came to me and said, hey, look, it's time for you to get promoted. You got to move to Minneapolis. Not something I was interested in doing at the time for my family and other reasons. And so while I was evaluating what did I really want to do next and did I want to go do the same thing again, run learning development for big organization, a couple major milestones happened in my life. I turned 50 and my father also passed away, who was my ultimate mentor. And so I decided I needed to change and I decided to go out on my own. So for the last 7 or 8 years, I've run my own business and I spend about probably 1/3 of my time doing leadership and management development programs for large corporations. Another 30% of my time I spend doing programs, facilitating programs like executive level selling and advanced negotiations. And then about 30% of my time I do individual one-on-one coaching. So I'm certified through UC Berkeley, their executive education program. And so that's more or less what my career's done. One of the most unique things I think I would share is over half of the roles that I had were newly created, which is really odd considering I spent the bulk of my career in huge companies. So I was really fortunate. I became known as somebody who, hey, we're looking to put a new department together. Who's got experience with building new departments and devising new departments in a big company like a J&J or Medtronic? So it became one of my calling cards, which again, I think was really beneficial.
I love so many of these career themes. And I'd love to dig in on some of these too. And so in terms of what you're doing now though, real quick, you mentioned a couple of things and some of those spaces are different skills, which I know I like to do lots of different things too. Do you find that the coaching and or the building capability and negotiation and or selling and some of those leadership development programs, how do those intersect with each other? And what kind of work do you love and why do you love each of those? I love kind of talking shop and understanding kind of the motivation behind some of the things that you're doing now.
Yeah, that's a fair question. So when I look at the three, so let's start with I do executive level selling and advanced negotiation courses. So I have such a strong background, you know, historically in corporate accounts, selling to large, in my background is medical device, so selling to large hospital systems and local systems in, you know, areas like that. So that really sort of lends itself to my experience that I've had. You know, I have the sales operations piece, so I've run those departments as well. So there's good synergy there. The other side, which is leadership and management development, is really my passion, right? I think it's the area that's lacking the most. Organizations are more than happy to invest in skill development like executive level selling and negotiations. But unfortunately, there's an epidemic of a lack of leadership and management development. So my work with the commercial organizations around the skills part puts me in a position to sort of pivot and suggest, hey, let's take a look at what are the challenges you think you're experiencing? Let's do some work and figure out what really are the gaps in the organization around leadership and really push them. So those two are pretty well aligned when I'm working with an organization. It's a somewhat of a natural expansion, I would say, of that. And then of course on the executive coaching side, because I work with so many leaders, that's really become an area that has been more of a focus lately. Although I'm very careful about how many individual coaches I have at one time. It's, you know, it's pretty demanding. And so you want to be able to really be present for those folks when you're talking to them and you don't want to mix them up. So I try to keep that limited to a handful at any given time.
Yeah. It's a thing in terms of the right, like your caseload, basically, right? This idea of how many, where are you in the process and not having all of them start at the same time, all of that kind of stuff. Yeah, I do a similar breakdown of some of the work that I do is similar in terms of consulting, facilitation, and coaching as well. So,
right. So, you know, yeah. Right. You know how that is. And the other thing that I think has been a huge advantage of mine is I went back to school for my master's in education very late. I was in my mid to late 40s, actually, when I went back and got my master's, which I'm grateful for because, like, you know, technology's changed so much and the approach to development of content's changed so much. And the advantage it gives me is with most consultants, a lot of them, or the bulk of them, are delivering content that they didn't create. And I, you know, that can be difficult, right? But most really master facilitators don't have, you know, aren't educated in instructional design. So I develop the majority of the content that I deliver, which gives me a distinct advantage. I'm far more familiar with it. I can adjust it. We do not, you know, not really an off-the-shelf practitioner. So pretty much all of my programs are really customized. I want to understand the organization, what their challenges are, and my relationships with my clients are long-term. If, you know, much as I hate turning down business, if an organization comes and says, hey, we have this meeting coming up, can you do 4 hours? That's not sort of the thing I do. Most of my clients have been with me for, you know, for multiple years.
Yeah. Building that long-term capability. That makes
sense. And it's not only the capability, it's also the idea that what are you looking to accomplish and how do we get there? Because most of those things cannot be done in a year, right? Based on the size of, you know, especially the organizations that I work with. So they really need to be long-term. Organizations that struggle, a lot of times organizations will come and say, you know, we need a new process because the last one didn't work. And I'm like, you really don't need a new process. You just need to enforce and have communicate an expectation of what the current one you're committed to is, right? A lot of times I'll say to leaders, you know, the money that you'd spend is wasted. You could just go back to the organization and have you really been driving the process that you put in place a year ago? And a lot of times the answer is no.
Yeah. And often too, I would hear, so I was learning and development at big organizations as well. And so just this idea of, hey, we need a training for XYZ. And you're like, do you really need that training?
Yes.
You probably don't need that training. Maybe it's more of change management, communications, enforcing the things that you said. Maybe training is a component of it, but the one-time training that you think that you need for this whole thing to work, that's probably not what you think you need. So, or what's going to get it done. But I love this idea of it is long-term. And I think sometimes that's one of the mistakes it seems like both of us are seeing that leaders make, is that some of this stuff, oh, it should just be a training, or, oh, it's just going to be 4 hours, or, oh, right. And so what other mistakes are you seeing kind of leaders make either in the development and capability build of their teams or other things that you're seeing in the leadership programs that you teach?
That's a pretty broad question. So a couple comments. First is the organization really has to be committed to long-term leadership and management development. It cannot be solved, to your point, in a four-hour session, right? It has to be a long-term commitment where we come in and I look at, first of all, to your point, what do you think the problems you're having are? Because in my experience, they're usually about 50% correct. You know, you think it's this issue and maybe that's part of it, but really let's, you know, so I will go in and I'll do a diagnostic. I'll do a number of interviews. I do prefer live interviews versus surveys and really sort of ascertain and figure out, okay, what are the real challenges that are existing here? And then find out from the organization, what's the amount of time they're willing to commit, right? A lot of times organizations will say, you know, we think we can commit 2 days a month to leadership and management development. I'm like, that's aspirational, but that's not realistic in any organization I've ever seen. So let's first talk about what is realistic. Maybe it's 2 days a month in person, or I'm sorry, 2 days a quarter in person, but in between we do reinforcement and remote development, but it has to be a plan that's long-term. Leadership is a journey. There is no end point, right? Even for me, I consider myself a student of leadership and I am always developing. And so that's probably the first thing I would say on that. When it comes to what are the most common errors I see organizations or leaders making, I would call to what are probably the first two that get addressed. So I spent 6 months doing a complete analysis of all the leadership and management programs and the data around leadership and management programs for the last 50 years. There's actually a ton of data on this, right? There's academic, there's industry, there's hybrid, there's meta-analyses of these programs. So there's actually a lot of data out there and looked at what are the top leadership and management competencies that make folks successful. And so it was a great opportunity to do that, to look at all this data. And in the end, we devised a list of about 20 competencies. Now, the top two are the first two. I'm not going to say the top two. The first two that almost always bubble to the top when I'm working for an organization of areas that need to be developed for the individual managers are interviewing and hiring, right? Because let's face it, success as a manager, leader is predicated on the success of your people. If you don't hire the right people, you know, you're dead in the water before you start. So interviewing and hiring is always one that's really paramount. helping leaders understand that you are looking to fill your team and outfit your team with what I prefer to call a diversity of thought. You know, I think we tend to focus on diversity, race, gender, and my approach to this is you're looking for diversity of thought, which in my opinion, in my experience, will ultimately help you achieve diversity of race and gender and those other areas. But diversity of thought really will help a team make sure that everybody's not thinking and operating the same way, that there are people on the team thinking outside the box and willing to challenge. So interviewing and hiring is probably number one. The second one, without a doubt, and I think it's one of the biggest gaps, is coaching. Leaders need to coach. I think coaching is the most important thing to help people be successful and your team be successful. And it's a massive gap that I find exists.
I could not agree with you more. The coaching, the kind of leader as coach mentality. Mm-hmm. I think there's not a lot of self-awareness on how good or not good we are at it as a leader. I think a lot of people think that they are coaching, but really they're fixing.
Yes.
And they're suggesting. Yes. And so it's really hard when you know the answer, right? To let that learning happen. And instead of telling somebody like, hey, here's the right thing to do, to get them there on their own through questions and through maybe not saying anything. Those are just really hard things to do.
Yeah, I would agree. And I'm a big proponent. I mean, I'm a fan of situational leadership, although to be very upfront, my experience with facilitating situational leadership is people are good three quarters of the way through, and then you get into some of the nomenclature, and I think people get a little bit more confused. So I'm actually a big fan of what Berkeley uses when I was in the Executive Institute there, which is this model of the four roles of a leader. And to your point, that first role is director, which is telling somebody what to do, but it should only be utilized when the person absolutely has no experience and no idea what to do. Different than what you just described, which is, you know, oh, that they're experiencing a problem, so I'm just going to tell them what to do, right? You know, the difference between that and being a coach is asking, you know, is first confirming everything that you observed, right? And you talking far less than the employee is. So, you know, saying, hey, Laura, you know, let's talk about what did we hope to accomplish with this project or with this meeting? You know, get the employee to state it so that there's no argument or question about it. And if there's something missing, then as a leader, we'd fill in and we say, okay, all of that, you know, I'm in agreement with all that. In addition, didn't we also agree we want to do this? Okay, all right, now what transpired? And let that employee talk through it. And then most importantly, when you get to the end of, okay, what went well, what didn't go well, and if we could go back, what would you do differently? And that's where the growth really occurs, getting the employee to think about those options. It's sort of like, I would say, like what we do as parents, right? And we do it all the time, where our child will do something wrong and our reaction will be, why did you do that? What you should have done was, right? We don't even give it a chance to answer. We don't even give a chance for them to communicate what their thought process was so that we can at least understand, okay, now I understand why they did what they did. But then turn it over to them and say, hey, what would have been a better or a different option to do that? And I'm a firm believer that as you move around that roles of a leader from director to advisor to coach to supporter, you know, your goal is to really get them to think about what they can do differently. And we know this from science. We know that people believe more what they say than what they're told. If somebody verbalizes something, there's something like 7 to 10 times more likely the next time they're in that situation to take that alternate action versus us telling them what to do. But as leaders, we have to be really diligent with that, because a lot of times we're moving fast and not every single situation you have the time to do that. But in the really important tasks and the really in the areas that the employee needs to grow and should be growing to be more and more successful and develop themselves for now and for the future, you've got to get them to verbalize those things.
My award-winning book, Values First: How Knowing Your Core Beliefs Can Get You the Life and Career You Want, is now available in audiobook. Since the book released just last year, the biggest question that I've gotten from readers is it available in audiobook? In this book, you'll get to hear my most pivotal career stories and some of the successes of my clients as you learn about the Values First framework and how you can take action on your life and career. The audiobook is narrated by me, So if you love this podcast, you'll love the audiobook. Values First: How Knowing Your Core Beliefs Can Get You the Life and Career You Want is now available on Audible and iTunes.
I think you're absolutely right. There's so many things that kind of stand in the way of leaders doing that, whether it, a lot of it's time, right? We don't have time to have these conversations. Sometimes it's like lack of self-awareness that this is how I'm supposed to be. What role should I be playing right now? Right. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I also just think that we as leaders think that we know the right way to do it. And so I think there's sometimes, right, there's that lack of being open to lots of other ways to have that same outcome. And if we ask different questions, then we'll get different answers that we may or may not be ready for or agree with. So we kind of have to take ourselves out of that. And I don't know that leaders are that great at that, or at least that's a struggle. I think that it happens often.
Yeah, I see it often because we all have our own ways of operating, right? Mm-hmm. And the reality is that we're not looking to develop clones of ourselves, and we're not going to be successful in our ability to do that. A couple of examples are, you know, I've been in situations before where someone will stand on stage and they will talk about how they lead or how they do something. And I'll have another leader sitting next to me watching this, and will turn to me and go, if everybody could just do it that way. And I'll look and go, yeah, but everybody can't. Everybody, that's not comfortable for everyone. So in any circumstance, especially when, whether it's leadership or selling or whatever it is, I always like to say, give people at least two, but ideally three different ways to do things, right? Three different examples. Cause I may watch, we do a lot of video reinforcement work, micro learning video work. And so I always say to the organization, provide three different ways to go about this, because I may watch this and I may see three examples and I may see the first two and like, yeah, there's, you know, it kind of works for me, but not really. Like, I'm not comfortable with taking that approach. But that third one, I may watch and it may click and I'll be like, you know, I can do that. I can feel comfortable approaching it that way. And there's so much of the ability to accomplish that is related to your own personal comfort and your own personal confidence, right? So you have to be confident and comfortable with the way you're going to deliver something. And so it's got to be something that you work on and is aligned to sort of your personality or again, what you know, what you're comfortable doing. So I'm a big proponent of that. You can't just emulate this individual or that individual. It's never going to be successful. You got to find what's comfortable for that person, which is also why as leaders, we have to understand what motivates every individual on our team. I do a lot of work with that where I'll say to leaders, do you really know what motivates each individual member of your team? Because I'm sure it's different across the team. And, you know, too many leaders always think it's money, and there's plenty of data to show it's almost never money, right? Yeah. If your employees are in the range, it is not a money question.
Unless it's not in the range, it's kind of that table stakes, right? Like, unless yes. It's off by a lot, that's probably not the thing. That's not the lever correct. That's going to pull. And I think too, often we do things that are similar to what we like, right? So the culture that I set as a leader, if I don't care about recognition as much, I am probably not going to be apt to do it for other people because it's not a motivator for me. But to your point, there is a huge range of people that like some don't love recognition, some totally need recognition. And so you need to understand where your folks are and how I like to understand, like, how do they want to be rewarded? How do they like to learn? Mm-hmm. And then how do they want to receive feedback? Those are some of the things that I like to dig into. So what do you think about this idea of just coaching, but then also that right balance of feedback as well?
Well, I'm a big proponent. I do a lot of work with, I'm a huge proponent of coaching in the moment. You know, feedback has to be timely for a number of reasons. Number one, because the more time in between the activity and the feedback, the more things are forgotten. And especially if it's developmental, let's be honest, much easier to deliver, you know, positive feedback and folks are always willing to that. And we love delivering that feedback, right? But some of the most value, we learn more from, we know as human beings, we learn more from our mistakes than we do from our successes. So, you know, understanding what our mistakes are, understanding how we can do things differently is critical. But the timeliness of that's important because there is less argument about what didn't transpire, right? If you wait a week or two, now you're in a discussion about, well, I don't think it really happened that way and that sort of thing. So I think that that's really important. But again, using a model where you're asking an individual, okay, what did we hope to accomplish? What happened? What would we do differently the next time? Is really critical. But I tell folks, you have to ask for feedback, which also applies to leaders as well. I spend a lot of time saying to folks, you know, when do you ask for feedback from your team as to what you're doing well and not doing well? So I ask you, Laura, when do most people ask for feedback? When do most leaders ask for feedback?
Well, they usually don't, but sometimes it's like that once a year.
Once a year,
how did it go? And guess what? That's not enough. I think a lot of the things that I see leaders do, they say, well, I totally asked for feedback, but everybody knows I have an open door policy. Well,
yes.
Right. Being open to feedback, but then actually creating opportunities for people to give you feedback are very different. Like having an open door policy. That's great. Sometimes people are not going to step in that door and give you that feedback because the door is there does not mean that they will come in. And you have to create that space for it.
There it is. You have to create that space. You have to create those opportunities. So you hit on the two things I hear most often. First is I have an open door policy. I'm always open to feedback, mm-hmm. right? Which your employees, your direct reports are, that does an open door policy does not equate to giving you feedback. It just doesn't. No one sees it that way. But the other most common thing is, you know, I'll say, well, when do you specifically ask for feedback? And the most common answer is, well, at year end review time. Mm-hmm. And I'll say to them, and do you prompt them in advance of the meeting that this is going to happen? Because that is one of the things that when I'm facilitating development for leaders and managers, I will say, look, here's what you should be doing. About a week prior, right? So let's talk about your annual review, right? Which is, to your point, not the only time you should be asking, but a week prior to your annual review, you should be reaching out and saying, look, during our discussion next week, one of the things I'm going to be asking you is to share two or three things that I can do differently or better. I want to give you time to prepare so that you come in prepared. Now, I used to take it to another level, or I would tell my folks, if you don't come prepared, if we reach that point in the discussion and you do not have things you've identified, I will sit and stare at you for as long as it takes for you to come up with them, right? And so, I would hire new folks and they would think it was a joke. And I did hire somebody new a while ago. And of course they showed up and I asked the question. They looked at me and they said, oh, I thought that was a joke. And I said, why did you think it was a joke? They said, well, I called somebody else on the team and they were like, oh no. And so they were messing with them. But I do always let them know, I want you to take time. I want you to come prepared with two or three things that are meaningful that I can do differently or better. And I will do the same thing throughout the year. And I encourage folks to do that because even if in the moment, so let's say you're doing a review and in the moment you say to your employee, hey, can you tell me, you know, from your perspective, what are two or three things that I can do differently? Even if in that moment they can think of them, they haven't had time to think about how to present them, right? You're talking to your manager. You want to think about what's the best way to present that. So people need to have time. So I always say to folks, you need to be thoughtful and you need to preempt folks. Hey, I'd like to have this discussion in the future, next few days, or when we're together next week. So please come prepared to share two or three things that I can do better. And, you know, what I find is, you know, to your point of self-awareness, some people are really self-aware. Maybe they hear three things and two of them they absolutely weren't surprised by, but sometimes that third one, they really are. Or there's a whole other group of folks that aren't self-aware that really need to be listening, you know, to the things that they think. Because we always, like organizations, I think it's just a ratcheted down, right? When I go to organizations, I say, what do you think your gaps are in leadership and management? They're usually about 50% correct. And so the same applies here, right? As an individual leader, I may think I have a good idea of what I could do better or differently, but the reality is I may not be completely correct on that. So you've got to seek it out, but you've got to give your employees time to really think about it and be prepared for it.
Yeah. And I love the letting them prepare for it. I'm a person who needs to process stuff. And so if somebody were to ask me, hey, Laura, what are two to three things that I can do better in the moment? I might answer you, but they're not the best things. Like I have not thought about it. It's not going to be impactful. I'm probably going to soft sell it because I haven't been able to think through it. I won't be able to come up with examples, and it's not going to be the most meaningful feedback. The other, so giving people a chance to just process, you'll get better feedback that way.
Absolutely.
And then the other thing I would say is how often, when you ask me that, the idea of when do you ask for feedback, once a year, and usually it's in that other person's performance review. And so If I'm a manager, I'm giving you feedback at your performance review at the end of the year. And then at the end, I'm like, oh, and what can I do better? Like, you're not going to get good information. It's going to be like, well, I need this. It's going to be like highly socially desirable. It's going to be the best you can do is to give them a separate conversation. So where we're not talking about their performance and my performance in the same like 1 hour. Otherwise, it's not going to be good information. But to decouple those things, I think is just really important too.
Right. Cause what's their mindset during that? Yeah. Right. I mean, if you've given them terrific feedback and they're really pleased, the last thing they want to do is give you things that you're not doing well.
Right.
If you've given them really some harsh developmental feedback, they're not in a mind space to answer you effectively as to, you know, or you might get a hard, it's not ideal, but it's gotta be regular and continuous. You gotta be checking in with your teams. And I love doing, like, whenever I work with a new organization, I'm working on one actually the last couple of days, I'm working with a new organization. And so I'm gonna be surveying not only the managers themselves, but surveying their employees as well to try and understand, hey, from a priority standpoint, how important are these skills from your manager? And then how well are they doing them, right? But I'm going to ask the managers the same questions to rate themselves, because I'm always very focused on where are the big gaps? Where are those items where the competency, the manager thinks they're really great at it, but the team doesn't think they're good at it at all? And how do we kind of figure out, okay, what's the miss here? Are we defining it differently? Or is it just that, you know, the team's not speaking up or not being vocal in any way or reactionary to the way the manager's, you know, handling this competency. So I look for those gaps, because those can reveal some real lacks of self-awareness.
Yeah, that's a really interesting to be the third party. I find that as I'm the third party, you just get some very quickly, you get some very honest feedback, I think. You do, right?
Way more honest than when you're within the organization. And most of the senior leaders that I work with are never surprised by that. They've been around long enough. They're like, oh yeah, But I think part of that is, if you've been doing what we do for a while, there's the safe space element of that. People feeling like they can be comfortable with someone. I mean, folks are always concerned about ramifications and risks of sharing that with folks in the organization. So, you know, I think there's just a greater comfort when you're talking to someone outside. It is interesting though.
Yeah, it is. It is. But I think still people are, it's another way to get that data.
Yes.
And then because of that, they then, I think, trust the data as well when they get that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, what other things are you excited about in this new year coming up?
You know, I'm seeing, because of the war for talent. I mean, let's really talk about, I think, one of the most critical things for leadership and management development is, what are we trying to do? We're trying to prevent, you know, regrettable turnover, right? We're trying to keep folks. What we know is, you know, post the Industrial Revolution, right? During the Industrial Revolution, number one reason people left jobs was their physical safety, right? My grandfather worked at Bethlehem Steel. People would perish on site during work. But post the Industrial Revolution, the number one reason people leave jobs is and always has been, and I think always will be, their immediate manager. So the reality is, when the organization loses somebody they wanted to keep, so often it's related to a lack of leadership or management competency in their leaders. So I'm excited, because as the war for talent gets tougher, there's more of a focus in organizations on preventing, you know, regrettable loss and you know, trying to prevent these folks from leaving, which is sort of translating into more of a focus on, hey, management leadership development is always at the top of our list of things we need to do, and it's always at the top of the list of things we're not doing. And so I'm seeing more organizations being willing to say, you know, look, we need to do this. The challenge is, understanding to earlier in our discussion, It's a long-term and continuous process. It is not a check the box that does not work. You have to really commit the time. And so I do, and the challenge with that is always that the departments and the resources within organizations are usually small. So I find myself doing a lot of work with them to sort of cadence, right? Let's talk about priorities. How are we going to cadence this? What resources can we put against these? Most organizations have the resources to develop and launch a great leadership management program, but the reality is that those resources don't have the time. And so finding that expertise externally and what I do is usually what's best for the organization. So I'm excited about it because I'm seeing more of it late this year and definitely seeing more interest in the next year. So that's exciting.
It's just been a pleasure to talk shop with you today and to talk about the things that leaders can be doing better. Is there anything else, any other actionable tips you would give the audience to either be a better coach, a better listener, a better feedback giver as we end our conversation today?
I think it's making sure you're making time. Your success is predicated on your team's success. I don't think there's any greater priority as a leader or manager than prioritizing time spent in observation and coaching and development of your teams. And a lot of folks and a lot of organizations struggle with that. I think technology's hurt us in that area, right? We're always available. There's just so many forms and means of communication. But I always challenge folks to say, when you're looking at your to-do list, right, not often enough we put in the names of our employees and that we need to touch base with them on whatever the last time was or observing them and working with them. Too often we just let that fall to the wayside day after day after day because we've got this long to-do list. And I always say to folks, you need to look at that list and you need to prioritize that, but you need to be prioritizing development of your people first and foremost above almost everything else. And so that's the one thing I would ask people to think about.
Love it. Well, thank you so much. It was really great to be in the same space with you today and to talk about all of these really important topics that are very actionable. So thank you so much for sharing your thought leadership and next steps as well.
Thank you, Laura. Thank you for your time and thank you for the work that you do here. It's awesome.
I want to thank you so much for listening to the You Belong in the C-Suite podcast. If you are enjoying this content, please remember to rate and review on Apple Podcasts. By leaving a review, you are helping others find this content. We will be featuring 5-star reviews on air in upcoming episodes. Editing and support for the podcast is done by S&E Podcast Management. To get more tips and tools to help you live a life guided by your values, go to thecatchgroup.com. Keep your boundaries and take care.